I do want to also address the question that Ambrosia brought up yesterday that I didn't have a very satisfactory answer and said I would come back on. In Exodus chapter 33, actually, as I looked at it again, it wasn't all that challenging. What you have is it follows immediately upon the golden calf episode. And in a sense, God, in his disgust with the people of Israel, says, okay, Moses, you and the people, just go on up. Okay, go up, take the land, take the promised land, you know, the land that was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Go on, but I'm not going with you. Okay, if you're going to reject me, these people are going to reject me, I'm not going to go with them. And so the people then mourn and weep, recognizing they're a lost cause without Yahweh. There's no way they could prevail. He's the one who's won the victories for them. It's the battle has been the Lord's. And so it's kind of an expression of sarcasm that God is saying, okay, just go on. See if you can do it on your own. Okay, if you don't think you need me, you know, if you think you can do well with your own gods, the golden calf and so forth, go on. See how you do. So that's essentially what's going on there.
There was no meeting at the time. Because I wasn't sure what comes after that Sinai.
Yeah, actually what happens is Moses, once again, intercedes for the people. And so there's like a second chance. Okay, so Moses goes back up on the mountain. You know, the Ten Commandments are given, and further instructions and other incidents, such as Moses beholding the back of God. So in a sense, God says, okay, I'm giving you another chance. Okay, any other questions about what we've covered thus far? You probably have questions about what our subject matter is today, and I encourage that, invite you to ask those, but it's probably most appropriate to bring it up as we get to that particular incident or event or material. Okay? So let's continue on here then. Today then we begin the conquest. And we'll be covering a number of books of the Bible today. So we'll discuss Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, and just a bit of 1 Samuel, but then also Ruth. And it's important for you to know, for the quiz tomorrow, which incidents and which characters are found in which of those books, which of those five books, okay? So just be attentive to that. So today now we begin the conquest. Before we do that, it's good to get our bearings in terms of what the setting is here. And we have to go back to the latter part of the book of Numbers. Okay? So we saw how yesterday how the Israelites crossed the Red Sea or Reed Sea, went down to Sinai, received the Sinaitic covenant, and then came up and were posed to enter the land and conquer the land immediately at Kadesh Barnea. But they faltered and they rebelled, and so now they are forced to wander for another actually 38 years. So it's a total of 40 years in the wilderness. They'll be in the wilderness before from the time of leaving the Egypt to the time they actually enter into the promised land itself. Okay? And you remember in the book of Numbers, it begins with the census. The census was to prepare them for military conquest. It's a census of the men 20 years and older, fighting men. Because of the lack of faith and the rebellion at Kadesh Barnea, the Lord declares that all of those who are 20 years or older will not enter into the promised land, except for Joshua and Caleb, who said, yes, we can take the land. Okay? So at the end of Numbers then, which would be towards the end of this 40-year period, they are now moving along the eastern side of the Dead Sea in order to prepare for the conquest, which will take place by crossing the Jordan River and conquering this territory from the east itself. Okay, they ask for permission to pass through Edom, but that's denied, so they have to bypass Edom. Okay, and they even kind of in a sense bypass Moab, but they settle in many ways here in the plains of Moab. At this time as well, they conquer this territory east of the Jordan River, which in the scriptures oftentimes is referred to as the Transjordan. It means it's across the Jordan River from the Promised Land, Transjordan, or the eastern side here. Okay, and so they conquer at Heshbon, and then even as far north as Bashan. Okay, so this territory now is conquered, and there are three tribes that ask for territory in this part of the geography. Okay, and those three tribes are, seem to have them here, but we'll get to them later. And Moses then promises to those tribes that they will be able to enter in, okay, from that conquest. Another interesting incident here has to do with while they're camped here in the plains of Moab, even after conquering this territory here, the king of Moab recognizes that he cannot defeat the Israelites by pure military might. He recognizes that there is a spiritual component here, a supernatural dynamic going on here. And so what he does is he summons the foremost wizard, spiritualist, if you will, of the ancient Near East, a guy by the name of Balaam, to come and to pronounce curses upon Israel. Okay, the king of Moab's name is Balak, and he summons Balaam, who is this wizard, this sorcerer, to come and do his spiritual, supernatural stuff on Israel. Well, Balaam comes, and there's interesting narrative, amusing narrative associated with that in many ways. But when Balaam then goes up on the hills overlooking the valley where the camp of Israel is, and he opens his mouth to speak forth curses, only blessings come forth. So it shows that God kind of circumvents, rewires Balaam's mouth so that blessings come out. And so he says to the king of Moab, I really can't pronounce curses. I spiritually speaking, I can't even do the combat that you're asking me to do. So the Lord here is protecting his people physically, spiritually, and even the curses of this wizard-like sorcerer are not able to have any effect on them. And in fact, the Lord, as he is quite able to do, even uses Balaam to speak forth truth in blessing Israel and prophecies. And one of the prophecies that Balaam speaks forth is one of the Messiah, okay, that a ruler will rise out of Judah. A star will rise. A ruler will rise out of Judah. So it just shows God's will is done even through those who do not follow him. Okay? But the one thing that does happen, which now will kind of set the tone for what we will see in the book of Joshua and Judges, is that the people of Israel encamped in Moab almost ready to go into the land for conquest here, are seduced. The men of Israel are seduced by the women of Moab. They're kind of saying, okay, come on, guys, you know, come on, let's have a feast, let's have a party. And associated with the festival, the feasting of the Moabites, is all kinds of sexual immorality and idolatry. And as we'll see later, for these Canaanite people, their worship is associated with sexual immorality. Or I should say, sexual immorality is associated with their worship. So by engaging in their sexual immorality, this kind of orgy, not only is that offensive to God, but there's idolatry that's associated with it too. And God then is angry, understandably so, brings judgment upon the people. 20,000 Israelites die. And so what it's really saying is that the only destruction that's going to come upon Israel is self-destruction and spiritual destruction if they allow it to happen to themselves. And if they will become a part of the Canaanite culture and its idolatrous, immoral activity, be persuaded and seduced into that, that and that alone will bring about the fall of Israel, the fall of God's people. Otherwise, no one and nothing can stand against Israel. So it's kind of a preview here of things to come. So this is where the book of Numbers ends then, in the plains of Moab, and this is where the book of Deuteronomy begins as well. The book of Deuteronomy, in the Hebrew, the title is Words, okay, because the first words of the book are, these are the words, Devarim, okay? In the Septuagint, it is Deuteronomy, which is Greek, and this means second law. Deutero, second, nomos, law. Okay? This does not mean that this is a second Mount Sinai and God gives additional law. It does mean, though, that as the people prepare to enter into the promised land, Moses now reminds them of the law, reminds them of the covenant, especially the Sinaitic covenant. And in that reminder, it's kind of a recitation, a second time through it. And that's why it's called here Deuteronomy. Okay? So where we are now here is in the plains of Moab, not yet crossing the Jordan River. One thing that I didn't discuss yesterday when we were looking at the Sinaitic law is that the law of Sinai, the covenant of Sinai, follows a pattern that we find in the ancient Near East, in other countries as well, for covenants. Okay, so there were other kinds of covenants, and especially covenants between countries, between conquering nations and their vassal nations, suzerains and vassals and so forth. Okay, and there's a lot of study, there's a lot of historical data for this that we won't go into. And yet we see something very consistent, and probably the best covenants that we have are the Hittite covenants, those that have been discovered from Hittite culture. They contain various elements. They begin with a preamble identifying the parties, and especially if it's a suzerain vassal treaty, it identifies the supreme suzerain, that is, the superior in the two parties. And then there's a historical prologue that identifies here what are the historical events that led up to this covenant. Thirdly, you have the stipulations. These are the terms of the covenant. This is what's expected of this party. This is what's expected of the other. This is what this party is to do. This is what the other party is to do. Fourthly, you have preservation and rereading. So there's stipulated, how will this covenant in its written form be preserved, and how often will it be revisited, be rehearsed, and so forth. Fifthly, then, are witnesses. Just like in a legal process, you have witnesses. So for this covenant, who are the witnesses to this agreement between these two parties? And then sixthly, there are blessings and curses. For the keeping of the covenant, there will be these blessings. For the breaking of the covenant, or there will be these advantages. For the breaking of the covenant, there will be these penalties, these curses. And interestingly enough, in Exodus we see this, where you have these elements of the covenant. You see this in Exodus chapter 20, where we have the Ten Commandments given. It begins, I, the Lord your God, identifying the suzerain here, the supreme party of the covenant. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, brought you out of captivity. A brief historical prologue. Then the stipulations are what we would call the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Those are the terms of the covenant. Okay? And then you have the preservation and the rereading of that covenant in terms of this is to be written down, it's to be preserved, it's to be recited to your children, to generation upon generation. And the witnesses that are called upon are the people themselves, but also all of creation, all of heaven and earth called to be witnesses. And then the blessings and the curses. The blessings are essentially, you will live in the land and you will be a blessing to others. The curses are, if you break the covenant, you will be expelled from the land. You will be vomited out of the land and taken into captivity. Okay? So again, this is primarily found in Anatolia, which was ancient, the Hittite territory. But it's also found throughout the rest of the Middle East. And so this kind of shows for the Sinai covenant, God made this covenant, but it's also a covenant of human commitment to God as well. Okay? First is identifying who God is. Second, the historical prologue, what he's done in bringing them out of captivity, the Exodus. The third would be the stone tablets, the Ten Commandments here. The fourth here is the recording in the scrolls and the provision that it be regularly read to the children, to the people, generation upon generation will be indoctrinated in this. Heaven and earth are called upon witnesses. And then blessings, if you keep the covenant, you will dwell securely in the land. Curses, if you break it, you will be expelled from the land. Now, what we see in the book of Deuteronomy is this same structure. Okay, all of Deuteronomy very clearly follows this same structure. Okay, and so what it is here in the plains of Moab here is kind of a return or a repetition of what took place here at Sinai. Okay, and that's again why the second law, Deuteronomy. What are some of the emphases here? First of all, the land. Will you stay in the land? You will if you keep the covenant. You'll be expelled if you don't. Emphasis on the Lord alone. And Lord here is with capital letters, Yahweh. He alone is the one that you worship. Have no other gods before him. And so it's in Deuteronomy that we have this great creed of the Old Testament, which is still considered to be the creed of Judaism. It's called the Great Shema. S-H-E-M-A. H-E-M-A, which is a Hebrew word for hear. Hear. And it's hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Okay? God is one, and He is our God, Yahweh, the Lord. Okay, so Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. So Lord alone is to be worshipped and honored. One sanctuary as well. The sanctuary that was provided, the tabernacle at Sinai, will continue to be the place where God dwells. Okay, so that is the place where you will meet God, is at that sanctuary that He has provided as the meeting place with Him, His presence there. And then the blessings and curses. Okay, blessings again. If you keep this covenant, you will abide in the land. You will carry out the purpose for which God has brought you here, the mission of the covenant. But if not, you will be expelled from the land. And then the challenge to choose. Choose for yourself which way you will go. And the exhortation to choose life. If you choose to break the covenant, choose other gods other than Yahweh, you're choosing death. So choose life today and every day. Okay, so here are some primary components of the book of Deuteronomy that are very significant here. First of all, the Ten Commandments. Okay, this is given again in chapter 5, almost verbatim from what we saw in Exodus chapter 20. Okay, so this is the second place in the Bible that you will find the Ten Commandments spelled out. The first place is in Exodus chapter 20. The second place is in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And it's easy to remember because Exodus precedes Deuteronomy. And also, if it's the second presentation, that's very appropriate for Deuteronomy, the second law. The Shema is there, Hear, O Israel, Lord our God, the Lord is one, Yahweh is one, and Yahweh is our God. But then also the great command, or great commandment, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So, not only do you confess Him to be the only God, but you also love Him. And all of the law is summed up in that command. The Apostle Paul says that in Romans chapter 13. All of the law is summed up in one word, love. Okay? Loving God. Now God also says the way you show your love for Me is loving others. Okay? So that's as Jesus said, a part of it or akin to it is that kind of second command, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Also in Deuteronomy, just as we saw in Exodus, since it's kind of a recitation of what was before, you have the instructions on how to carry out the various feasts, such as especially Passover and Yom Kippur. And this is very significant because the evidence, as we'll see soon, was that the Israelites had not celebrated Passover during those 38 years of wandering in the wilderness. Okay? This is not so much because they fell away. It's a penalty because they rebelled. So Moses is leading them, but apparently he had been directed by the Lord. Everything is on hold now, okay, with these people for these 38, 40 years. Everything's on hold. So they don't have the Passover, okay, which is the celebration of deliverance, and they also do not circumcise that sign of the covenant. That will be resumed, as we'll see here, now soon when they enter into the land. We also then have the succession of leadership from Moses to Joshua. Moses identifies his successor in chapter 31, and then in chapter 34, when Moses dies, Joshua takes over. Okay, and then you have instructions about these three primary offices that will serve and lead the people in the future. The office of king, the office of priest, and the office of prophet, and a reference to the prophet. Now, this is highly significant because you do have priests at this time. You do have prophets. Moses himself was a prophet, and he says, "The Lord will raise up a prophet like me," but you don't have kings. And so it is saying, it's recognizing from the very start here that the Lord intends for his people to be led by a king eventually. Okay? But lays down very strict instructions. The king is really a vice regent. Yahweh remains the true king. The Lord is the true king. It's a theocracy. And really the king, human king, will simply be a steward of the kingship of God, a vice, second in rank. And so, as a steward, he must manage the people and manage the leadership responsibilities according to the law of God, the will of God. And so the problem later on with the kings is not them being kings. That's okay with Yahweh. The problem is the way they turn away from the Lord and make themselves, number one, rather seeing themselves as servants to the Lord and stewards to him as the true king. Okay, so we also have a somewhat cryptic messianic promise in Deuteronomy chapter 18, beginning with verse 15, that discussion of the office of prophet. And Moses there says, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers." Okay? And this, no doubt, is a reference to the fact that God will continue to send people who will speak his word. You can count on that. And there are some criteria that are given in chapter 18 that you'll be able to know whether this is a true prophet of Yahweh or a false prophet. So it's speaking of that. But there's also an indication that there will be a supreme prophet. And particularly as God continues to reveal his plans for saving humanity, with the latter prophets in what we call cumulative revelation. As things become clearer, as there's an expansion on this kind of embryonic prophecy here, that it grows and expands, it becomes clear that there's a reference to the prophet who is the Messiah. And so when you get to the time of Jesus in the first century, you remember Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do men say that I am?" And one of the responses was, "The prophet." Okay, so they were saying he's the one that Moses here predicted. Another, I think, important thing about this, though, is that the Messiah, the anointed one, will be not just the prophet, but he'll be the priest and he'll be the king. So he's the prophet, priest, and king altogether par excellence. That's why he's the Messiah, Mashiach, which means the anointed one. All of those together. Okay? In chapter 30, this is another important passage here, but here we see some of these important emphases of the covenant that Moses delivers here. And he says, "I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day." Remember the witnesses in the covenant? So he's saying, "I'm calling all of creation to be a witness of this, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore choose life, that you and your offspring may live, that you may dwell in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And what we will see here in this subsequent narrative in Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, we will see then that when God's people do follow the covenant, they choose life, they receive blessing. When they depart from the covenant, then they are choosing death, and they are expelled from the land of promise. Okay? A couple of other important things about Deuteronomy, then, is that this is really a kind of sermon that Moses gives, kind of an elongated sermon. It may have been a sermon series that he gave. So it's written in homiletical form, in sermonic form. It's very much like preaching. Okay, so you can consider it the sermons of Moses. The second thing is that this style of Deuteronomy now has a very, very significant influence upon the historical books that follow, which in the Hebrew canon are called the former prophets. So, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. So much so that those are referred to as the Deuteronomistic history. It's a history that reflects these kinds of themes, the themes of God's given you the land as a gift, honor and worship the Lord, Yahweh, alone, okay? Do so where he makes himself known in the sanctuary, the tabernacle, later the temple, and the blessings and curses. Blessings if you do, curses if you break the covenant, and especially the curse of being expelled from the land, exiled from the land. Those are major theological themes that we'll find in the historical account. And they're really the theological hermeneutic, interpretive principle for the historical accounts that follow here. Finally, at the end of Deuteronomy, then, Moses himself dies. Okay? And he dies on the east side of the river. Just before he dies, the Lord takes him up on a mountain on the east side of the river in Moab, Mount Nebo. And this overlooks then, as you look to the west, you see the Jordan River Valley immediately to the west and to the north, the Dead Sea to the south. I'm speaking this because I've been there. I can just envision this, a high mountain, very low valley there. And then on the other side is the Promised Land. So God took him up there so that he could see the Promised Land. But he's not able to go into the Promised Land. Do you remember why? Right, because of his obstinance in striking the rock, disobeying the Lord. Okay? So then he dies, and the Lord personally then buries Moses. Chapter 34 of Deuteronomy says we don't know where his burial is. No one knows for sure. But the Lord buried him somewhere there in Moab. But he did not get to see enter into the Promised Land. Now this woodcut here that you have is reflective of a later, this isn't in Deuteronomy or anywhere in the canonical Bible, but some later Jewish tradition, which is described in the book of Jude, about the devil combating with Michael, the archangel, over Moses' body. Okay, that the devil sought to acquire that. And so it's not in the canonical Old Testament. The book of Jude makes a reference to it. Jude really uses it more as illustrative material. So Jude is not necessarily saying this is what happens. He's kind of using it as an illustration of another point. But But you should remember that it's at the end of Deuteronomy then that Moses dies, which brings us then to the book of Judges, Joshua, I'm sorry, and at the book in the book of Joshua now, as the namesake indicates, Joshua will be the leader. So Moses is the writer of the first five books, Genesis through Deuteronomy. And so when Deuteronomy ends, that's where he dies. And probably this chapter 34 was an appendage. Obviously someone else wrote it and appended it to Moses' writings. Okay, any questions or comments, concerns about Deuteronomy? Okay, well, let's move forward here then to the book of Joshua. Okay, the book of Joshua and the conquest. You remember that God's now his calling of Abraham, and that Abrahamic covenant had the three elements of promise: the land, offspring, blessing. Blessing to the adherents of the covenant, but ultimately blessings to all nations, that this would be spread and shared with everyone. God is seeking now in Abraham, as he's narrowed his focus in terms of the population of the world to this man, to his offspring. His intention now is, using the metaphor that I had before, to establish a beachhead of land and people who will be righteous so that God can eventually reclaim the whole world, land and people, essentially the peoples of the world, as his righteous as well. Joshua now will reflect the claiming of that land. The book of Joshua, I should say, reflects the claiming of that beachhead, okay, for the kingdom of God. And it also, it more importantly, reflects the claiming of God's people and how they will live and behave to be positive influences on the rest of humanity. Okay? But there is this issue of holy war. Okay? And you can't get around it. We've already seen it, okay, in earlier books, but it really comes to prominence in the book of Joshua. Holy war, where the Lord calls his people to go into this land and to exterminate the inhabitants. Those who will not leave, exterminate them, including their animals, destroy their cities, burn everything down, okay? Don't take plunder, burn even the valued possessions, the precious metals. Those are taken for the purposes of the Lord, for his sacred purposes. But the Lord himself commands and commissions the people to do this. And, you know, there are some ethical issues associated with that. So let's have a discussion of this question. How do we as Christians understand and accept, or maybe you don't accept, Yahweh's command to the nation of Israel in the Old Testament to engage in warfare and kill?
Seems like to me it's almost like genocide. You're going in and just wiping everybody out. so yeah. that I guess they don't mix with them and taint them, maybe.
Okay.
But it's also only if they don't leave, right? I mean, if the people fled before them, they wouldn't keep chasing them. They would stop once they've gotten their land. So the real focus is on receiving what was promised to them by God, not necessarily obliterating a people, but because that people were in the land. I mean, not that I understand it, but that seems to be a component at least.
Okay.
Kind of going off that, I think it's an example from history of God showing that nothing's going to stand in his way of fulfilling his promise.
So even those who reject him, who and their heirs as well, who have rejected him, their will not prevail against God's will.
Which as a Christian can give us great hope in the promise that he gave us through Christ.
Indeed. Good. I think all of these are excellent perspectives. Anyone want to add?
Something that struck me when we were in the New Testament was there seems to be a pretty sudden, I mean, this whole concept of stoning people, you know, for the bad things that they had done, that seems relatively prevalent in the Jewish culture at the time. But once Christ comes, Christians no longer take part in those kinds of activities. And that struck me, it seemed to be like a pretty distinct line of now this is different. You know, the people stone, it's like with Sapphira and Ananias, they were punished, but they just dropped dead. They weren't stoned by the people. And so there were punishments that were carried out, but it was never with the brutality and kind of bloodshed that you see here. So that just struck me when we were in New Testament, how it seemed to be a great distinction between before and after.
Right. And an important distinction. And what you have in the Old Testament, if you haven't already seen it here, is in Israel, is a theocracy. Okay? Theocracy where God is king of these people. And he is king, both in the spiritual and religious sense, but also in the political sense. He is king. Okay? And so you have, as we saw yesterday, in the law of Sinai, civil law with certain penalties, capital punishment for certain crimes and so forth, ways of society organizing itself in terms of its civil behavior, okay? So what you have in the Old Testament, if you're familiar with our Lutheran distinction between the two kingdoms, the two realms, there is no distinction in Israel between those two realms. The right hand and the left hand, they're one, okay? So you have God ruling through the government, okay? In terms of his will. Now, in the New Testament with Jesus, you see a distinction coming right away. Jesus himself said, "My king," to Pilate, you know, to this representative of civil government, he says, "My kingdom is not of this world." Okay, if my kingdom were, then I would behave differently, but my kingdom is not of this world. You don't have to sweat here, Pharaoh and your emperor, Augustus. I'm not planning a revolt here, political revolt, military revolt. Jesus said to his own disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Put away your sword," to Peter. Don't you know that if I wanted to, I could summon down legions of angels to defend me? This isn't a military political coup that I'm embarking into here. So we see the distinction. He speaks of the kingdom of God, but now the kingdom of God is primarily what we would call the right-hand kingdom, where God rules through his grace. And there is the left-hand kingdom where God also rules. He's still king here. He rules through established governments, and he rules through the sword. But there is a distinction now. And so the church, which is the right-hand kingdom, is not to take up the sword to advance its causes or its mission. Okay? Likewise, government is not to make edicts and so forth in terms of doctrine and what is to be believed. Okay? That distinction is made here. Okay? So, and Paul makes this very clear in Romans chapter 13, where he speaks of the government taking up the sword as God's instrument, and yet we do not take up the sword to advance the causes of the church.
Is this then? I take it then Luther's the one that brought this to light, because you've got the Crusades, and you've got like Henry VIII that came in with the Church of England. You've got a lot of history there, so he's the one going, let's get this understanding right.
Right, right. You've got, I mean, you've got those mixed up throughout the medieval church. Okay, and this was considered a real threat to the papacy and so forth, which essentially assumed political power and political control as well. And so it's a central theme in the power and primacy of the Pope, that document in our Lutheran confessions. Okay? So the thing I want you to be clear in here is that things are different in terms of God's administration today in the New Testament era as in the Old Testament period with Israel, with this nation of Israel. And another problem that a lot of Christians get into today in terms of interpreting the Old Testament is then they take the political operation of God in the Old Testament and try to apply it today, okay, in terms of the religious right, even here in America, and thinking of America as a Christian nation, okay. Well, that's a mixing of the kingdoms there, confusion of them. Or regarding Israel, that, well, Israel, the nation, the political entity, we have to support no matter what, because God said, you know, whoever blesses Israel will be blessed, whoever curses Israel will be cursed. Well, according to the New Testament now, the true Israel of God is the church, the universal church. Paul makes that very clear. It's not a political entity anymore. It's distinct in that way. So I'm sure you'll be getting a lot. Some of you may already have gotten into some of those doctrinal matters, but you'll be getting into that deeper here at the seminary. But this is kind of a preview of that. Okay. Now, in terms of this concept of holy war, the conquest is not only God giving a gift to his people Israel in this land, but it is also his bringing judgment upon the idolatrous and immoral people of Canaan. Okay? So that distinction needs to also be made, that dual purpose of God. He's giving the gift of the land to the people. And he still owns it. He can take it away from them, especially if they become like the idolatrous and immoral people of Canaan, which will happen, as we'll see. Then he brings judgment upon his own people. Then he exercises holy war against his own people, if you will, against the descendants of Abram. Okay? So, with this conquest, then, we have both the deliverance of the promised land, the promises to God's people, but also judgment, judgment of those who oppose God's people. And it's not just about land, it's about theology. And I think that Pastor Rossow has a good but brief excursus on this topic as well that you will do well to read about the kind of theology that was practiced by the Canaanites, and that this just had to be expelled, it had to be expunged from them. Okay? So, there's the reasons that are typically given in the scripture here has to do with the iniquity of the Amorites, the iniquity of the Canaanites. That goes all the way back to Genesis 15, verse 16, where God said, I will expel these nations when the iniquity of the Amorites has reached its fullness. And that was 500 years later, after he says that, then he will act on this, which shows not only his judgment, but his mercy and his long-suffering. He waits that long before bringing the judgment upon these people. William F. Albright, some of you may be aware of him, he's considered the father of American biblical archaeology, highly respected, is deceased for quite some time. In his, just looking at the historical archaeological artifacts of the culture of the Canaanites, said this. He said that they practiced, quote, the most depraved religion ever. Okay? They were the originators of hard pornography, okay? Orgies, just like the Moabites that we saw here, even before Israel went into the land, orgies were a part of their regular life, ritual prostitution, idolatry of every kind, child sacrifice, homosexuality, just very, very prevalent, venereal diseases. You know, I hesitate to say this, but just so you can see the depth of the depravity, bestiality was very, very common. Okay, so that's a part of the whole issue of killing the animals as well, and the venereal diseases that were associated with this. A while back, a magazine, Biblical Archaeology Review, any of you ever seen that magazine? Okay. They had a pretty significant debate over whether they should provide photos of some of the artifacts that were found from the Canaanite culture, the erotic artifacts, just because of the, you know, the, what's that? Yeah, yeah, and you know, the perversion. Is this even possible for us to demonstrate? So, the land needs to be expunged from this, and God's judgment must come upon this. The second consideration in this has to do with the influence upon the Israelites, okay? And we've already seen when they simply tolerate it, then they get pulled into the behavior, and they get pulled into the idolatry, and they get pulled into the sexual immorality. The incident in the plains of Moab illustrates that very, very well. So there's this risk of infection that as Israel settles in this land, there's the risk that they will be infected by this sin. A fine Old Testament introduction by Lesore and Hubbard has this to say. A surgeon does not hesitate to remove an arm or leg, or even a vital organ when life is at stake. The spiritual life of Israel, and ultimately of the world Yahweh wanted to bless through Israel, was at stake. So Yahweh ordered surgery, the removal of these people from the land. Okay. The verdict of history, however, is that Israel disobeyed God's command, didn't remove the people completely, and was in fact infected by their behavior. We'll see that clearly as we look through particularly the period of the judges. And so it came to pass that way. Okay, we need to move on beyond this subject. And the subject is not a major one for the exam, but I think it is one that we just cannot go past, you know, through this portion of Old Testament history without addressing. If you want to go deeper, I think that this particular explanation of the concept of holy war, the ethical question of war in the book of Judges, Joshua and Judges, is a very clearly written one. And you'll do well to read what it has to say. Explains it well. Okay? Now, another thing associated with holy war here is the concept of devotion. Okay? The word in the Hebrew is kerem, not pronounced with a soft, the CH, soft cherem, but kerem, from the Hebrew word, letter chai. And during the conquest, the Israelites are to devote, this is where the word was used, devote entire cities to destruction, killing everyone and everything, and burning the spoils of war. Okay? Which is another indication that this is not simply a kind of, what, you know, candy coating of Israel's ambitions to gain the benefits of warfare that we see throughout human history. That they're not just engaged in this war in order that they can get rich from the plunder, okay? But everything is to be devoted to the Lord. And if it's contaminated by Canaanite idolatrous practice, it's destroyed, okay? So the burning of that. So the people don't go in and just kind of take what they want, claim what they want. This is devoted to the Lord. This particular map then, from the crossways, see through the scriptures that you have, gives a commentary on this graphic as well. I don't remember what page. And once again, I wish to give credit to Harry Wendt and the originators of the Crossway series for, I think, some of these very helpful and useful graphics and images for us. But here you have Canaan, Palestine, and this is the route now. They are encamped here in the plains of Moab. There's Mount Nebo where Moses went up to see into the promised land. Even at the end of the book of Numbers, as I said before, this territory here is conquered and claimed by the Israelites, okay? And so now they are posed to move into the promised land. They then are to prepare themselves before they cross the river. Well, here, this is still talking about holy war, I'm sorry. I need to backtrack a bit. God will also use other nations, such as the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians, to bring about his holy war against apostate Israel. So it goes both directions. When Israel becomes as corrupt as the Canaanites had been, then God will bring other nations to exercise his judgment upon Israel. For us today, though, with the distinction of the two kingdoms, in the right-hand kingdom, the only sword that we use is the sword of the word, as Paul says in Ephesians, okay, and Hebrews also describes the word of the Lord as a sword, to battle Satan, okay, so we don't take up physical swords for the sake of the gospel. We may, in our lives in the civil realm, the left-hand kingdom, be called to take up swords to defend our country or so, whatever, but not for the cause of the gospel. We only use the word of God and trust his work in doing that. And it's then that kind of spiritual warfare against Satan and the demons that we are to engage in today. Okay, now let's talk about the conquest. And here we've got the chronicle of that, step-by-step historical narrative. The conquest will take place essentially in three stages, or three phases. There's what's called the central phase, and that begins first. They cross over and defeat the central part of Palestine. And then the southern phase, the southern part of Palestine, and then move up and the north. Okay? So it's a kind of divide and conquer strategy that's used here as they cross over. Joshua then is the leader who is called upon to lead in this conquest. Okay? As we've already seen then, they've come here to the plains of Moab, camping here. They've defeated the Transjordan eastern part, claimed that. And before they embark in the conquest across the Jordan River, they send spies into Jericho. Jericho will be the first city then to be attacked. And they send two spies, and those spies then are to scope out the situation, reconnaissance, very standard for military practices and invasions and so forth. And the spies are housed by whom? Do you remember? Rahab. And what is her profession? Prostitute. That's right. Okay. So how did they ever get connected with her? A prostitute.
She lowers a rope and brings them in the wall.
Okay, she actually lowers them out of the wall. Okay, her home is adjacent, that means her house is attached to the wall. It's very typical. So she's in the wall of the city. But they come in of their own free will. But when you have visitors, this is a ruse for them. It's not saying that they are engaging in prostitution, but this is their kind of cover. Men would regularly go to the brothels. This is Canaan, okay? Remember, I've just described the society. So, you know, the inns are essentially whorehouses. That's where people stay. So this is where they're staying. She recognizes who they are, but she does not snitch on them. She says, I know that you guys are going to prevail. I'm going to side with you, and I'm going to support you and protect you, okay? And so she does, and in fact, the king of Jericho discovers that these spies are there, and he's got his troops all over town looking for them. She hides them up on the roof of her home, so they don't find them in her home. And then, as the picture here demonstrates, she lowers them down so that they can escape down the city wall. This is a significant, why is this so significant? I have to tell the rest of the story. Before she lets them go, though, she says, promise me, almost in covenantal language, she says, promise me that you will not kill me and my family when you come here. And they make that promise, the two men do. Okay. What's significant about that? That when they do conquer Jericho, Rahab and her family are spared, and they are then allowed to live among the people. In fact, the line of David descends through her, and the line of Jesus. Okay, you want to check the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, Luke chapter 3, the line of Jesus descends from Rahab as well. Okay? So, theologically, why is this significant? Okay, she's a foreigner. She's a Canaanite woman. I thought they're told to exterminate all the Canaanites. But she has claimed the true God. And you look at her confession of faith, she says, I know that your God is the true God. And so even foreigners, even Canaanites, the issue isn't just what nationality they are. The issue is their faith. And so for those who will trust in Yahweh, they are incorporated into the community. The issue is for those who will not. They must be destroyed. Okay. So even a prostitute here is accepted by Yahweh on the basis of a confession of faith, repentance, if you will. Okay. So I think this is very significant. Next, you have the crossing of the people into the promised land across the Jordan River. Okay? And it's across the Jordan River, not as we typically think of a cross on a bridge, but through the Jordan River on dry ground. What happens here is that the Ark of the Covenant is taken by the Levites, carried by the Levites, and the river piles up once again as it's like coagulates, almost the description, piles up. What does that remind you of? The Red Sea. Okay. So just as God's people had passed out of slavery through water, through the walls of water, so now they pass into the promised land through the walls of water. It's kind of deja vu. And this is highly significant. They're entering into God's covenant promise through water. For us as Christians, of course, we make the associations with baptism, that we are delivered out of the slavery of sin through the waters of baptism. And we are brought into the promised land of God's covenant through baptism as well, through the covenant of baptism, as we call it. Okay? The ark, though, doesn't just keep on going. It stops in the middle of the river, really the riverbed, we should say. And then the people go through around both sides of the ark. Okay? And then when the ark, when everybody's through and the ark crosses to the other side, then the waters begin flowing as well. But before that happens here, there are stones that are taken from the riverbed. Each tribe is to take one stone, and they build a kind of memorial out of those 12 stones on the other side. It's kind of like, well, you remember when we had men land on the moon in 1969. They placed the American flag there on the moon, kind of claiming it. So these stones then are kind of the claim of this territory. This is now, this belongs to the 12 tribes of Israel. But even more than that, it's a memorial. It's a memorial so that people can come back and remember how God brought his people now into the fulfillment of the promise. Okay? So this is what you have. And then they encamp right there at a place called Gilgal. So, and thus we'll begin here the first, the central campaign. But there's some significant things that happen at Gilgal, right on the other side of the river now in the land that they will conquer. They reconsecrate themselves. There's a consecration to the Lord and to the covenant. There is a massive circumcision because none of the newborns from the time of Kiriath Jearim, that rebellion, for 38 years have been circumcised. Everything has been put on hold. Those 30 years of wilderness, 38 years of wilderness wandering are just kind of the pause button that God put on. so that that generation could die. And so now there's the circumcision, which is in a sense saying, okay, things can resume. Covenant promises now can resume. The same is true of the Passover. They celebrate the Passover now for the first time since that incident in Kiriath-Jearim 38 years ago. Also, now that they've entered into the promised land, there is the cessation of manna. For all these years, God has sustained them in the desert with the supernatural gift of manna. And now there is no longer manna. And they actually celebrate the Passover from the fruit of the land, okay, from the produce of the land there. In Joshua chapter 5 then, well, that takes place in Joshua chapter 5 as well, but towards the end of chapter 5, Joshua then goes to do some reconnaissance of Jericho to kind of scope it out, and he encounters this warrior, this commander, okay? And Joshua says, whose side are you on? There's a battle coming up. Whose side are you on? And this warrior says, I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. So it's once again saying, God is coming to fight this battle. God is the one who will lead the battle. And many believe that this is actually a theophany, a presentation of the pre-incarnate Christ, because of Joshua's response. He bows before him, but he also takes off his sandals, okay, because this is holy ground. The commander says, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. Where have we seen that and heard that before? Okay, what place? The burning bush. And there was God himself. So this is, again, I think a good evidence that this is God himself taking human form as this commander for the sake of Joshua to assure him, I am leading in the conquest. Okay? You know the story of the Battle of Jericho then, where it was essentially the Lord's. They just, for 7 days, once each day, they go around the walls of the city. On the seventh day, they go around seven times. And that while the Levites are blowing the trumpets, everybody yells the war yell, and the walls come tumbling down. The archaeological excavations by Garstang and Kenyon from this time show that the walls fell both directions. Which they would associate with an earthquake. It wasn't just from battering rams and so forth. Fell both directions. So the people were able to go in, and again, the battle was the Lord's. He won the victory. However, remember the devotion, the cherem? Army marches on to take Ai, A and an I here, just a little further on. And in fact, Joshua says, well, you know, we don't need to send the whole army. We can just send 2,000 to 3,000 men. That'll be enough to take this little town. And in fact, the Israelites get routed. They're chased back by the warriors of Ai. And everyone's wondering, what is the problem here? I thought the Lord assured us of victory. What's gone wrong? Obviously, the Lord has deserted us. And what has gone wrong? One of the community has taken some of the plunder from Jericho for himself. And so by the process of casting lots, they identify who it was, a fellow by the name of Achan. Achan. He confesses and says, I buried, you know, the loot the booty in the sand under my tent. They go and dig it up, and sure enough, it's there. And so the penalty is that he and his family and all of his animals and such are stoned. Okay. There's a couple of principles here. The Lord takes seriously his commands, and the people are to obey and not take this for their own personal use, but that there is a corporate impact. So what Achan did affected the whole community, certainly his family, who were also stoned, but the whole community, those soldiers who lost their lives, the defeat from the men of Ai, that's a part of it too. Okay, so he's stoned. The next step then, though, with that behind the way, out of the way, is to go back to Ai. And Joshua uses a brilliant military strategy here. It's an ambush that, from friends that I have who've attended the military academies, they say they still study this. This is one of the historical accounts that they study in their war history courses and so forth, the brilliant strategy that they have. Once again, Joshua, first of all, he sends some forces to go around to the other side of the city of Ai to kind of hide out in the hills and forests and so forth on the other side, the western side of Ai. Then he sends another contingent of forces, you know, I don't know, another 3,000 or so, to Ai. And the same thing seemingly happens as what happened before. The warriors of Ai come out. They chase the Israelites. They think, once again, we're gaining the victory. Okay. But as they're doing so, they leave the gates open. All the soldiers have left chasing after the small contingent of Israelites. They leave the city unprotected. And the other Israelites who have hidden around the back, you know, crept around the back, come in, take the city, set it on fire. And so this is the image you have then. The soldiers of Ai who have pursued these fleeing Israelites look back and they see the smoke billowing up from their city. And they think, uh-oh. And then Joshua and his forces, who had been feigning this retreat, turn on them, and the other soldiers, Israelites from the city, come at them, and so these soldiers are surrounded, and they're defeated as well. So the Lord continues now to bless. Okay? Next we have, we're just about ready for a break here, but just hold with me. Next, we have the southern campaign for the southern region there to be conquered. And there's a couple of interesting battles with these southern city-states. By the way, these southern Canaanite cities join in alliance with one another, a coalition. They say, hey, we can't fight these guys by our own. So they join in a coalition to fight against the Israelites. And in one particular noteworthy battle, the Canaanite forces are defeated by hailstones, a hailstorm that pummels the soldiers with huge hail boulders. I mean, you can see the artist's depiction here. And it says that more of the Canaanites were killed by the hail than from the actual sword-to-sword combat, or arrows and so forth. So the Canaanites retreat. And during their retreat, they are hoping that they'll be able to retreat under cover of dark, but the Lord makes the sun stand still. Okay? Joshua asks, and the Lord causes the sun to stand still. And so they have, you know, you can basically just fight during the day in those ancient times. They didn't have night goggles and so forth. So there was no escape into the dark. And the victory is complete. But again, the point is, the Lord won the victory. It's God's victory, not the people's victory. And then the kings of that coalition, five of them who have hidden away in a cave, are discovered and captured and beheaded and so forth. Finally, then you get the northern campaign, and by this time, there's not much that's said about this northern campaign. In the north, the city-states again come together as a coalition, recognizing that they need an alliance in order to prevail. And the victory is won, and the main city of Hazor is breached and destroyed as well. Okay, and that's a woodcut depiction of the destruction of Hazor. Okay, so essentially now at the end of this section, narrating the chronicle of the conquest, you have Israel in control of the land. But this does not mean that they have obeyed the Lord and gotten rid of all the Canaanites. There's still a lot of Canaanite presence in the territory. But this is where we're going to stop and take a break at this time. When we come back, if you have any questions about the narrative history of the conquest itself, we can address that.